Hello and welcome back. I'm Pierre Daly, and this is Insight is Capital. Markets are heading into 2026 with momentum, but also with a shrinking margin for error. Tariffs, labor shortages, shifting central bank regimes, and a wave of fiscal stimulus are reshaping the investment landscape in real time. In the latest monetary policy moves, the Bank of Canada hit the pause button, and the Fed just cut its overnight rate by another quarter point. So what should advisors expect from the year ahead, and where are the real opportunities hiding beneath all the noise? Today, we're joined by someone who can help us make sense of it all. David Stonehouse is AGF Investments Interim Chief Investment Officer and Head of North American Specialty Investments. He's been steering through one of the most complex macro backdrops in years and an environment where tariffs collide with central bank pivots, fiscal engines rev back up, and global growth leadership is shifting in ways investors haven't seen in over a decade. In his latest outlook, David lays out a roadmap for 2026. We're going to unpack that roadmap, explore the risks he's watching most closely, and discuss how advisors and investors can stay flexible and opportunistic as the cycle matures.
This is Insight is Capital. Join us in our fireside chats with some of the most fascinating people in finance to discuss their insights on life, markets, macro, investment strategy, and much more.
David, welcome. It is terrific to have you here.
Thanks very much, Pierre. Really appreciate the opportunity.
We're excited to have you. Thank you so much again for joining us. David, before we begin, I'd love it if you could tell us a little bit about the arc of your career and how you got started in the business in the first place.
Sure, absolutely. So I have an undergraduate degree in engineering, followed that up with an MBA focusing on finance and accounting. Started out in the 90s working for a private industry. I was at Nortel for a number of years, at TD Bank a little bit. And then I went and got my CFA designation, Chartered Financial Analyst, and moved over to the street, Bay Street. Started out at a pension fund, OMERS, and then moved from there to a private asset management company called Acuity Investment Management. And there I was focusing on equities and then also later on bonds and multi-asset solutions, so balanced solutions as well. Acuity was taken over about 15, almost 16 years ago by AGF, and that's where I've been ever since.
Wonderful. You described the path forward as narrower but still constructive. From your perspective, what are the major forces shaping the macro landscape as we head into 2026? And how are tariffs reshaping economic behavior across businesses and consumers?
Yeah, so for the first part of your question, Pierre, I'm going to focus on initially a half dozen positives that we see in terms of the backdrop for 2026. The first is monetary policy. We have been through one of the most significant easing cycles of the last 15, 20 years globally in terms of central bank easings. 90% of the central banks of the world are in easing mode. And that tends to operate with a lag in terms of stimulating economic activity. We think that's a positive backdrop that remains in place for 2026. There are a couple of caveats to that. We do think that the potential for further easing is diminishing. We think that some central banks are approaching the lows that they're likely to achieve for this cycle. So we would anticipate, for instance, as you mentioned, the Bank of Canada looks like it's pretty close to, if not already, at the end of its easing cycle. But countervailing that, the most important central bank in the world, the Fed, we believe is still very much in an easing cycle. And so that's a favorable constructive backdrop for 2026. The second is fiscal stimulus. We're seeing economies around the world apply more fiscal stimulus in 2026. In North America, we've got pretty substantial deficits and a lot of fiscal activity from the Trump administration. Increasingly in Canada, more of the same, not to the same magnitude, but certainly there's been a significant pivot on the part of the Liberal government under Mark Carney to focus more on spending on things like defense infrastructure, all that sort of thing. So we think that's constructive. And it's not just a North American phenomenon. We're seeing similar stories out of the likes of Germany, Japan, China, and so on and so forth. So that should provide a bit of a boost, economically speaking, next year as well. The third factor is deregulation. We're anticipating deregulation. Again, the focus very much is on the Trump administration when it comes to this. They're kind of leading the charge in terms of a desire for more deregulation. But we're also seeing that in Canada as well. There is a concerted effort on the part of the Carney administration to sweep aside red tape, get things done. And deregulation tends to be a positive backdrop for markets. It involves removing red tape, obstructions to getting projects done, those sorts of things. And so that should be a favorable backdrop as well. The fourth thing is that earnings trajectories continue to be healthy. We've seen double-digit earnings growth this year in a lot of jurisdictions around the world, and we're anticipating a pretty healthy backdrop for earnings next year as well. That tends to be very constructive for equities, for stocks in particular. So we think that should continue to be supportive. It's also good for credit. If there's more cash flow than bonds on the corporate side of things tend to be well supported. The fifth, we're getting good breadth now. We're seeing a broadening out. There's been a lot of focus in the last 2 or 3 years on the narrow U.S. large cap mega cap tech growth stories leading the charge. And obviously that has been true for much of the last 3 years. But recently we started to see a little bit of a broadening out. We don't think that those stories are done, but we do think that there's a greater degree of participation starting to unfold here. And that should be fairly healthy as well. And finally, I would say there's a strong political imperative here in the United States in particular next year. There are two major things looming in our view. The first is midterm elections. The Trump administration is really going to be focused on doing everything they can to provide a favorable backdrop, improve affordability, and get the votes they need to try and retain control of Congress going into the midterm elections. And the final point to note is that next July 4th is the 250th anniversary of Independence Day. And we're convinced that Trump is going to want to celebrate in style. It is another hallmark of his approach. And so that should be a favorable backdrop. So by and large, we see that as a constructive set of tailwinds for 2026. I'll pivot to your comments on tariffs. In our view, what happened between February and April was really the earthquake in terms of tariffs. Yes, Trump had talked about them in the past, but I don't think that that investors and people at large in the economy really believe that he was necessarily going to follow through to the extent that he did on those threats. And so that was the real shock to the system. Everything that we've seen since then has dialed down gradually that shock. It's important to note that tariffs have not gone away. They're still very much here. But as we start to see more clarity, as deals get negotiated, as there's a higher degree of resolution, it doesn't mean that tariffs won't continue to be a headwind, but it does mean their ability to shock the market is very much diminished. Nobody's going to be surprised anymore if there's another curve out of left field or something like that. So as consumers and businesses can start to get their arms around what these tariffs are going to look like, even if they don't go away, it's beneficial for the economy next year because then they can start to go back to a normal modus operandi and conduct their business as they'd like to while working within the parameters of those tariffs.
David, that was a very comprehensive overview of the tailwinds. It's interesting. I mean, it feels, and it has been to some degree, but it feels like it's been a very tumultuous year, and mostly because of a lot of political grandstanding. And, you know, to your point on the tariffs, I think that's still a topic of discussion, but it's almost as though we've gotten used to the temperature of the water. And to your point, I think it's that, you know, there isn't any surprises left to be suddenly like heaped on us. I think it also stands to reason that you know, 85% of Canada-US trade is covered still under USMCA or CUSMA. It's the 15% that's not, that may have some impact on the economy, like steel, aluminum, autos. That's where really the sort of choke point is where tariffs are concerned. It seems like we've really, you know, we're like the frogs in the boiling water, right? We've just gotten used to the temperature.
The downside of that analogy is the fact that the water eventually boils and it's a bad outcome for the frog. I think the difference in this case is that, to your point, we have become more used to this, we become somewhat inured to it. You don't want to go too far down that path. By no means would I suggest that there are not going to be any further twists and turns in this saga. We know the way that Trump himself and that administration has tended to operate, and they will make pronouncements out of left field, especially as the negotiations for Kuzma heat up next year. That's going to happen. It's really, what is, first of all, from a capital markets perspective, as investors, what's the capacity to shock us? It's far lower because this is front page news every single day. And it doesn't mean he doesn't pull a rabbit out of his hat tomorrow. And it looks like it's really bad for, I don't know, the dairy industry, right? That possibility exists, but it's just not going to shake the markets to the same extent. We've got Supreme Court decisions coming down on the IEEPA tariffs, which are something on the order of 2/3 of the total amount of the tariffs that have been imposed. There's every possibility of an adverse ruling there. That's going to throw some interesting shockwaves into the marketplace. Then Trump will probably turn around and administer end runs around that approach and utilize other sections of the legal code to allow him to implement tariffs in a different way. So this is going to go back and forth and all over the place. But again, we're in the aftershock mode now in terms of not the magnitude 7 earthquake, but the magnitude 4.5 aftershocks. Those are the sorts of events that we're probably going to get from the subsequent activity next year. The thing that's important to note is that we have not seen a lot of deals signed yet, almost anywhere. We know in Canada, we're covered by most of USMCA. We know that there's a risk that the negotiations don't go well or it even falls apart. But at least we're sheltered to some extent. And certainly, I think that the Trump administration's desire to focus on the Americas probably stands us in good stead. We have a lot of things that they need and we can be beneficial. But all of these announcements that were made earlier in the summer and the fall with all these countries, they're not signed deals. They're announcements. Right. So this story is not going away next year. Again, it's more a question of getting increasing clarity over the time as to what is going to be implemented. And then consumers can say, oh, maybe I won't buy as much of this because there's a high tariff on it. Maybe I'll buy more of that. And the businesses will say, maybe I can source stuff from over here in my supply chain instead of over there. That's what's going to happen. And that should result in an increase in economic activity, all other things being equal.
That's the real risk, right? Is the extent to which it puts spending plans on hold, how that impacts the economy. And hiring, obviously, right? I mean, labor. How are labor market dynamics and the evolving stance of central banks, both here and in the U.S., shaping your expectations for economic growth next year?
So you've hit on a key aspect of that, just as a follow-on from the tariff situation. There is no doubt that consumers and businesses paused to some extent in their economic activity because of the uncertainty surrounding the tariffs and not having a clear sense as to where they were going to land, whether they would take effect, to what extent, the numbers kept moving, all that sort of stuff. That tends to result in a hiring freeze, all other things being equal. If I'm a business, I'm not looking to add costs to the bottom line without thinking I'm going to get a good return on that investment. And in an uncertain world, you don't know if you're spending on the right things in the right way, so you keep your powder dry. That's one aspect that has kind of weighed on the labor markets over the course of the past year. I think a second aspect has been around AI. We think that it's very early days here, and we're not in the camp of the doomsayers that suggest that we're going to get a wholesale massive transformation that's going to result in widespread layoffs or anything like that. What we believe we will see there is increasing adoption, and it's still in the early days. So this is not having a significant impact on labor markets so far, but it is at the margin affecting them a little bit. We've started to see that in areas like youth employment, tech employment. It's not so much massive layoffs as it is a lack of hiring in those areas as businesses figure out how to do things more effectively with AI. But as I say, this is a leading edge of the wedge. It's early days. Don't think that's a large factor on labor markets right now. The third thing is immigration. So we know that the Trump administration came in early this year, with a desire to focus more domestically, to keep out illegal aliens, all that sort of stuff, and to actively deport people they felt shouldn't be in the country. And so a combination of deportation and curtailed immigration has really dampened the supply of labor and has shifted the nature of it, because those elements of illegal aliens or freshly landed immigrants, they tend to have certain skill sets that would be more conducive to certain sectors than others on average. And so that's really skewed the labor market and probably dampened it a little bit. So you've got a lack of desire to hire on the part of companies and a lack of supply of labor due to the immigration and deportation situation. And as a consequence, you've had what's been called this no hire, no fire economy, where we've had labor employment gains on a monthly basis at a very moribund level. We take a look at the Canadian side of things, and it's rather interesting. First, the Carney administration pursued a pretty similar policy, certainly not active deportations and certainly not anti-immigrants by any stretch of the imagination. So it's not like the Trump approach in that respect. But in Canada, there was an increasing backlash just because of the sheer magnitude of immigration. I think Canadians are very broadly supportive of immigration. We're a nation of immigrants, and that makes sense. But it needs to be appropriately calibrated. We can't take on too many people all at once. And frankly, that's what happened in the last few years. So that cutback had similar knock-on effects in Canada. Less supply of labor, significant uncertainty around USMCA, which hits Canadians more than it does Americans because we've got a more trade-oriented economy than they do. And as a consequence, you get a pretty uncertain labor backdrop and higher unemployment in both countries. And that's the trend. That's been the trend over the course of this year. I would just say lastly on the Canadian employment figures, the last few months have been stronger on the surface, but under the hood, we don't think that numbers are quite as good as they appear on the surface. So we still think we're in that soft labor environment for both Canada and the U.S.
There's such a bifurcation in views, right? There's a lot of talk about the K-shaped economy. The positive backdrop for the market is what really matters when it comes to investment. You highlight fiscal policy as a bright spot for 2026. How do you see U.S., Canadian, and global fiscal actions influencing economic momentum, and where do you expect to see the most meaningful impact?
Yeah, you've touched on a bunch of good points there, Pierre. I didn't get into the specifics of the fiscal stimulus coming out of the U.S., but as you noted, One Big Beautiful Bill Act is the driving force behind that. We see the potential for that based on various estimates to contribute at least 0.5% to GDP growth next year, just on the basis of tax refunds. So we're going to see a lot of activity early next year in the form of consumer tax refunds. The second significant aspect of stimulus associated with that is on the business side of things. It's going to be the accelerated depreciation for capital investments, for R&D, those sorts of things. And those two combined, we think, are going to be the real driving force behind the fiscal stimulus that we're anticipating in the United States for 2026. So that should be positive, but you made an excellent point that we're looking at what people have been terming for some time now, a K-shaped economy. The Trump administration's popularity has been slipping, and they are very mindful, belatedly, I think, and they've come to realize this in the last couple of months, of the fact that affordability is a key challenge and has become a real watchword now. For people in the lower income cohorts, they're struggling. And they don't have a great deal of disposable income. And a fair amount of that has been chewed up by the likes of 30% increases in food prices over the last 5 years or more. Utility prices going up, electricity prices going up at a 6% annualized pace in the last several years. The interest rate shock that we went through 4 years ago that resulted in mortgage rates more than doubling off prior levels in the United States and moving up pretty significantly in Canada as well. All of those factors have really weighed on disposable income. And so for 2026, we do think that's going to be a key area of focus, is to try and alleviate some of those challenges and provide more support to the lower income cohorts that really need it. There's been talk about potential refund checks being issued to Americans who would qualify for that. That's going to be interesting. First of all, whether it passes, it's by no means any easy feat. And it does result in, you know, we've used the term in years past, helicopter money. It does result in potentially a one-time sugar high, but it has ramifications down the road. It just increases your deficits, all that sort of thing. And sometimes consumers won't be willing to spend it. If they know that it's a one-time benefit, maybe they'll just use it to pay down a little bit of debt or save a little bit more for a rainy day because they're in dire straits in some cases. So you may not get as much benefit out of that as you'd like to. But for sure, it's an area of focus. There's a real emphasis on trying to improve affordability. One area we've seen that in is on energy prices. So notwithstanding higher electricity prices, we've seen very much lower gasoline prices as supply of oil has been kept pretty high in the last couple of years and demand hasn't been able to keep pace. So that's one area where you've been able to alleviate some of the concerns around affordability. But that's what makes this situation tricky to target from a policy perspective. It's not easy to isolate and target through effective policies the areas of the economy that you want to prop up or support or stimulate while avoiding overstimulating other areas. So some of the moves that have been made have been very good for capital markets. That helps the high end. That just exacerbates the inequality issue and the populism challenges that we're facing. I think for monetary policy, this is a real challenge. Do we focus more on the potential for some of these activities to reignite inflation? And we can touch on inflation a bit. By the way, we don't see that scenario right now.
Right.
Or should they focus more on the fact that employment figures have been really soft and try to stimulate the economy to promote more hiring and help unemployment levels come down? And that's been a real area of dissension for the U.S. Federal Reserve in particular in recent months. And it's also a tricky area to navigate for other central banks around the world is to balance out potential inflationary implications of stimulus against the soft underbelly of the economy that we're seeing in terms of labor in, you know, a number of jurisdictions.
Yeah. So this week's, to your point, I mean, there was dissension this week. This week's Fed announcement, this week's Fed rate cut, the last rate cut of 2025, it wasn't just a rate cut. There was also the announcement of $40 billion a month in bond purchases, that the Fed ramping up bond purchases, particularly in the T-bill market. So that introduces some more possibly volatility rate action in the bond market. On the fixed income side, like, I mean, it's hard to believe that you know, we've got on one hand, the economy is booming, you know, by so many different measures. And at the same time, here's the Fed coming along with not only a rate cut at this point, but, you know, on the concerns of things softening up, but the $40 billion a month quantitative easing or new, I mean, not sure they called it that, but that's what everybody else seems to be calling it, right? Is a new round of quantitative easing. What does that do to the fixed income side? Like, how do you think about the push and pull that's happening between high government debt? We've had range bound yields and then the shifting inflation mix. Like there's a lot of different views on whether or not inflation comes back. How does that look as we move through 2026?
You touched on a number of different points there, Pierre. So I'll try and address several aspects of that question. First, I don't think most people would characterize the economy as booming right now. When you look at GDP growth, both in Canada and the US, we're in the ones. So we're below what most people would view to be potential growth rates.
Yeah. So without getting political, I think Howard Lutnick has a different opinion.
He does. And if you look at something like an Atlanta Fed Now estimate of Q3 GDP growth, it's at 3.5%. Q3 is already mostly through Q4. But the fact is that there are some real quirks and adjustments to what's going on there in terms of inventories and net exports, which have been highly disrupted by the whole tariff announcements early this year. Underlying final demand is in the ones. It's not that strong. So yes, politically, there are going to be characterizations of this and different shadings as to how well or how poorly the economy is doing. But from our perspective, we believe that we're moving from a period of somewhat anemic growth to the potential for an improvement and some strengthening in growth next year as a consequence of some of these positives that I talked about. And there are a few potential negatives too, which I haven't touched on yet, and you've alluded to in your last point here. But I would say that on balance, it's not a booming economy, even though there are certain sectors that have been booming. And it's an economy that looks like it has the potential to improve and broaden out next year. And that's encouraging. The second point, the whole notion of QE, yeah, we would take exception to that. And I think a number of observers would as well. What's basically happened is that after a massive expansion in the Fed's balance sheet early, and frankly, the Bank of Canada's and a whole bunch of other central banks around the world, early this decade to combat COVID, we've seen a gradual reduction in the size of the balance sheet over the last couple of years, what's been called quantitative tightening, which has essentially been, for the most part, allowing bonds to mature that are on your balance sheet and not fully reinvesting the proceeds in the bond market and keeping the size of the balance sheet the same, but allowing it to attenuate over time. Eventually, you get to a point where the balance sheet has shrunk back to being more in line with the underlying levels that would be appropriate for the size of the economy. And that's basically the point the Fed's gotten to. The knock-on implications of this are that eventually you get to a point where there aren't enough reserves in the system to support the banking system, and you run into some tightening liquidity conditions. And so that's what the Fed was really addressing this week. Right. And they tried to take pains to explain this so that people didn't get too hung up on or caught up in the notion that maybe QE is starting again. The focus is very much on T-bills. It's very much on providing that short-term liquidity need to make sure that we don't run too short. We often see a little bit of a hiccup around year end. So frankly, they accelerated the restart of this program a little bit faster than we were anticipating. It will also help them going into tax season next spring. But normally the balance sheet grows over time, and it grows with the nominal growth rate of the economy. So there should be an expectation of some of this activity happening, but it's very much more in with the goal of maintaining ample reserves. It is not with the goal of stimulating the economy. And they've really taken pains to state right. that. So in our view, this is not quantitative easing. It's not a negative, but it's maybe not as stimulative as some people are thinking that it could be. The next aspect of your question that I think is highly relevant is the notion of deficits and where we stand in terms of fiscal responsibility and also fiscal expenses, costs. And that's becoming an increasing challenge. And it is not an American one. It is a global one. So we're seeing a number of jurisdictions where this has been coming to a head to varying extents in the last few years, and is a very much an area of ongoing focus. We've seen real disruptions in the sovereign bond markets in the last few years of the United Kingdom, of France, of Japan. Last decade, some of the Mediterranean states, the likes of Italy, that sort of thing. And even recently, to some extent, the U.S.'s fiscal situation has been called into question. And where that's manifested itself is in the long end of the curve. There's not too much concern as to whether or not these nations are going to be able to service their debt over the short term and roll it over and all that sort of thing. But if you're making a promise to lend to a sovereign for 30 years, that's a long time. A lot can happen in 30 years. And so it's the long end of the curve that has borne the brunt of the concerns around the sustainability, not just of these deficit levels, which in some jurisdictions are quite high, 6% or more, but the debt levels outright, and that's a major concern. So for central banks and for treasuries, the key is to try and make sure that you can keep a lid on interest expense costs so that you can service your debt and you don't run into significant problems, and try and avoid getting into an accelerating inflation situation. You definitely would want to be able to see a healthy degree of inflation to inflate away the problem to some extent, but you don't want it to become runaway inflation. And you want to keep a lid on long yields. And the more inflation you have, the less you have a lid on long yields to keep those interest expenses reined in. So I do believe that central banks will selectively in different jurisdictions target that to try and adjust their balance sheet holdings to, on the part of treasuries, their issuance areas, to try not to have that manifest in too big an interest rate problem, which of course cascades through to the real economy because it affects borrowing costs for mortgages and businesses and all that sort of stuff. The last thing I would touch on is inflation. We believe that we're very much in a disinflationary environment right now. Inflation has been coming down for 3 years. It's kind of become sticky here in the upper twos sort of range, depending on which jurisdiction you're looking at. A significant component of the calculation for inflation in the United States and Canada is related to housing. And we've still got, as we know, very, I'll say frankly, punk housing environments both in both countries. You've got outright negative prices in both countries to some extent. So that hasn't filtered through fully to the calculations yet, but it has been happening gradually. We think that's a tailwind for disinflation. Plus, you've got, as we talked about, not great underlying final demand economic growth. And that should kind of help that disinflationary trend remain intact. I think achieving the 2% target might be difficult, but right. I'm not worried about a reacceleration in inflation for the time being. I think down the road that could become more of a problem. So if we get towards the end of next year, we anniversary some of the disinflationary trends, maybe that starts to pick up again. We're watching commodity prices closely. They've been starting to tick up with the exception of oil. That's something to keep an eye on. But for now, we think that that trajectory is very favorable, and it is helping support bond prices or keep a lid on bond yields.
Yeah, I think, you know, looking back over this year, I think a lot of investors were surprised when, you know, the rate cuts began and continued over this past year, that at the long end, and especially like on the U.S. 30-year, the yields pretty much stayed in the, you know, north of 4.7% range. And the unexpected element was the term premium. That happened last year. It happened this year. But, you know, keeping a lid on those long-term yields is really, it's really where you see the push-pull happening, is this activity. The Fed has such a tough job, when you stop and think about it, of balancing between inflation and neutral and disinflation and possibly deflation. The far worse outcome, obviously, is deflation. But disinflation is friendly at this point. So, I mean, in terms of looking at the gymnastics that the Fed has to do in order to keep that balance, you know, there was also, I think during the course of the year, there was the push and pull happening between the Treasury and the Fed, and the fiscal dominance versus monetary dominance argument. That's probably still underneath it all, but the discussion has gone away. And, you know, there were calls for the Fed to cut rates because the tightening stance was too tight, too hard for the economy to try and achieve that 2% inflation target that you mentioned. That is a tough target to reach. And if the Fed is dogged in its attempt to do that, they could overshoot on the tightening. And maybe it's not so much that politically Powell was being pressured to cut rates, but when the rubber meets the road, Powell had to make a decision as to what's right for the economy, what's right for the central bank. And, you know, it looks like that's what he's done. And seeing as he's on his way out, that's his legacy, right? Which is I almost got the feeling that given what's happening politically with whether or not there's going to be Warsh or Hassett at the Fed chair, it seems to me that Powell is doing his very best to be able to look back on his time as Fed chair. I did everything I could to make sure that we stuck to the right course, that we did the right thing for the economy. And so it'll be interesting to see what happens next year once we have a new Fed chair.
Yeah, I think that's correct. I think he has very much tried to stay the course of the mandate that he's been given, that's enshrined in law there in the United States. And it is a dual mandate. It does focus on both inflation and employment. And quite often, it's relatively easy to determine that you should be easing or you should be tightening, because those figures align closely enough that taking that action supports the improvement of trying to get to an equilibrium on both sides of the mandate. But it's a blunt tool, as they've acknowledged, using interest rates to try and fine-tune the economy. you cannot target everything perfectly with the instrument of monetary policy, just interest rate positioning. It's difficult. I mean, even for other jurisdictions, Canada's notable in only having a single mandate, inflation. There are forces at play that will push you in both directions. And so it's not an easy thing to do. I think you're right that they have tried to conduct policy with good intentions to try and satisfy the obligations of the mandate. And it's imperfect, as is always the case. I think part of maybe something that's a little healthier than people give it credit for that speaks to that is the fact that there's a fair amount of dissension right now. I thought Powell's best answer in his press conference on Wednesday afternoon was around the tensions on the FOMC between those who feel that policy is certainly loose enough and don't want to see it loosen anymore, and those who feel that it's still too tight and they need to move more. And he said, look, we all agree that the labor market is uncomfortably soft, and we all agree that we haven't fully achieved our target on inflation. The only difference is we're debating, and he said, it's a very healthy, respectful debate, the best I've had in my 14 years on the Fed. We're debating what path to take to try and improve both of those, and what's taking precedence, and what are the risks of a mistake if we zig and we should have zagged or something like that. So they're acknowledging the fact that this is a tricky environment to navigate, and recognizing that there are aspects of this that could move in either direction. That dissension is not going away, and there's always debate, and that's a good thing. But it's going to be an interesting situation for Powell's successor to inherit as we get to the middle of next year.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting as well where he said that now we're in a position to watch, wait, and see what happens.
Yeah.
Like we're in the best position to be able to observe what happens next without, you know, without any potential, you know, risky moves or shooting themselves in the foot.
Yeah, the only thing with that is that you always wish you had more data. Forget the shutdown. Yes, we lost some data for a while. Now we're getting it back. There's a little bit of a gap there that they're never going to be able to fully fill in terms of accurate portrayal of what went on during those 5-6 weeks. But the reality is the future is always uncertain, and they're always looking for a little bit more information, as are we all. And you have to operate in an environment of imperfect knowledge and uncertainty. So I think the shutdown maybe highlighted that a little bit more, but it's not as if it was a light switch where we had all the information we could possibly want to, we have no information to, oh, now we're starting to get all this information back again. It's not like that. It's always a murky future, and you have to discern what you believe to be the best path forward in an uncertain world that's going to have twists and turns and doesn't move smoothly.
That's good to know. You know, that, I mean, that's really good for the armchair monetarists to know.
Yeah, I think you can have a lot of fun in this game, just as you could looking at NFL football games the day after and saying, well, why'd you make that play? Why'd you do that? It's no different here having a parlor game of second guessing the Fed.
Absolutely. As the bull market matures, what gives you confidence in equities for a potential fourth year of gains? And how are you thinking about regional allocation and areas of opportunity?
So the greatest confidence that we have is in the earnings trajectory. That is one of the key inputs, one of the key underpinnings to what happens to equities. During periods of healthy or expanding earnings growth rates, the stock market tends to do pretty well, and vice versa. So the fact that we have been able to generate double-digit earnings gains and next year looks like we're on track for another year of the same is a very favorable backdrop in and of itself. The second thing is that if you're going to get this fiscal and monetary stimulus, that does two things theoretically. One, it should improve economic activity, and that means there's more money going around, and that means theoretically more profits to be had and all that sort of thing. The other thing it does is, I don't know, I shouldn't say ignite animal spirits, but it certainly enhances whatever animal spirits already exist to begin with in terms of optimism around the capital markets. And as a consequence, you can get more participation in the markets, improving sentiment, and you can often see multiples expand as a consequence of that. those are the primary backdrops that are favorable. I guess the third thing I would say is if interest rates do come down a little bit more, then your discount rate becomes more attractive, and that, all of the things being equal, results in higher valuations as well. So that's a pretty good confluence of events. I would say that the challenge that we face is, first of all, valuations.
Right.
On any given month or quarter, valuations tend not to matter that much in the short term, because it's going to be all these other factors that we've been talking about that are going to be more significant in driving what happens to stocks. But over the long term, we know that the valuation starting point is a very significant influencer on your total return prospects. And if you are near historically high multiples, that invariably ends up limiting potential long-term gains down the road. And this is where we start to have a little bit more concern about the U.S. market. We've taken it down to equal weight earlier this year. We still don't think that it's an area to avoid just yet. There's so much to recommend the American market in terms of innovation and earnings growth rates and all that sort of stuff that we would be very wary of discounting that too early. But we've had a really long run here, really good run. You mentioned if we do get an up year next year, it'll be the fourth year in a row.
Mm-hmm.
If we do, it would be the seventh double digit. Let's just pretend for a moment that we're up 10% or more next year. If that were the case, that'd be the seventh year of double digit gains in the last eight for the S&P 500. That's a pretty strong run. Yeah. So valuations are a risk here. They leave less room for error. If things go really well, you can probably at least get your earnings growth rate as your gain in the market, right? The price keeps pace with the earnings. You have the same PE multiple a year from now, and you make, let's say, 11% or something, depending on what you think the earnings growth rate is going to be. And I think it's reasonable to anticipate it's going to be pretty healthy. Maybe people get more euphoric and you get a little bit of multiple expansion, and that goes up to 15% or 20%. But there's clearly less room for multiple expansion, given that we are at historically high levels here, than there is for contraction. So if we get any sort of a correction along the way due to any sort of a catalyst, the potential for multiple contraction is probably higher than for multiple expansion. In other words, there's an asymmetry there just because of the starting point. So that is something that makes us a little bit more wary. When we look around the world and consider opportunities, where have we seen sustained periods of underperformance? Europe has been one. We are more constructive on Europe. We're not really positive on Europe yet, but we're constructive. And the reason that we're not really positive on Europe is we're still not seeing the strong earnings growth rates. We're still not seeing much in the way of economic growth. We hope that some of the stimulus that's being discussed gets applied. But if it doesn't, and you have another year of 1% odd GDP growth, and that results in another 4%, 5% earnings growth or something like that, then Europe's not going to do fabulously well. It could be fine. It's got room for multiple expansion on, to a greater extent than the U.S. But it kind of leaves us lukewarm at best.
Right.
Emerging markets look more intriguing. There are better growth rates there. The multiples have compressed quite a bit over the last 15 years, and they've just started to tick up more in the last couple of years. This is for the whole complex of emerging markets. There have been certain winners over the years where valuations are much higher. India's done well over the years as an example. But by and large, you've got attractive valuations relative to some of the developed markets and better growth prospects. And obviously, you have greater political risk and that sort of thing, or currency risk. But that looks really intriguing to us. So we've gone overweight emerging markets. Canada is another area that has chronically underperformed the U.S. in the last 15 years. But if we see an increased demand for resources to fuel this new economy, it's not just supply chain re-engagement, it's not just infrastructure spending and all that sort of stuff, or defense spending. It's not just AI. Just the sheer demand pickup could be beneficial to some of the resource areas. And it looks like that's been starting to happen over the last while. And Canada could find itself standing in really good stead in that respect, because we have a more prominent allocation of resources in our equity market, in our index, than most other indices around the world. So those are some of the areas that start to look a little bit more appealing. We haven't yet gone overweight Canada, but we certainly are more constructive on it. Undemanding valuations, I think a good, healthy financial base, and the potential for an uptick on the resource side of things, maybe the industrial side of things, transportation hasn't been good. So that looks better. And then finally, we're actually still quite positive, as we have been for years now, on Japan. We think the reforms that have been underway there, started a decade ago by Abe, those have been paying dividends over time. And we think that's going to continue under the current Takeuchi government. And that should also be an area that has good potential for strong returns. On balance, we're constructive, as I mentioned before, and we think it could be another good year. But there's less room for error given the strong run that we've had over the years, the higher valuations, the more elevated sentiment. Certainly, right. People are not bearish right now. Retail is outright bullish. Institutions may be somewhat more sober. But that is the soft underbelly of what looks like a pretty healthy headline opportunity for stocks for this year, meaning this coming year.
Fantastic. It's very nuanced, right? I mean, if you consider, you know, some of the overhang or concerns about overhang in the U.S. equity market, it's certainly not a time to get out of U.S. equities, but definitely rebalancing some of that overhang into other areas and shifting to neutral or shifting to an equal weight in the U.S. market makes sense. So you maintain your exposure, but you take some of those out of distribution returns and redistribute them to, you know, other markets like Canada. Like we had a period in the 2000s where the Canadian market outperformed the U.S. market during that period of the lost decade.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
But it coincided with the increase in the commodity complex.
And that's exactly what happened. Yeah. So what you often see is a handoff in a secular environment from something that has been doing really well to something that has been really lagging. And you get that paradigm shift. Obviously, in the 2000s, it was a move away from the internet side of things, the technology more broadly. It wasn't just internet. And we had a massive pickup in resources led by, you know, China joining the trading block for the world and starting to benefit from that very significantly. So that was the real driver that time. I think this time around, gradually you would expect to see something similar play out. We are probably in the latter stages of what's been a tremendous technology run. We believe that AI looks outstanding as a real economic theme, just as the internet did. But just like the internet and prior technological revolutions, it's going to result in a lot of creative destruction, probably over allocation of capital. And over time, we'll see survivors that will do tremendously well, and the whole economy will benefit from the technology, but it'll take quite a while to assimilate. And I wouldn't be surprised to see that play out again this time. And this time around, maybe the resource benefit accrues to areas that are looking for an energy transition to a more electrified economy, to reshoring and infrastructure, more defense spending. You know, we've got infrastructure that's two generations old, that sort of thing. And in addition, there's a need for a lot of these materials to support that technology economy. So all of those factors could be the driver this time around, rather than the Chinese joining the World Trade Organization or something like that. So that is a longer term theme. Again, right. We don't think that the story is over for U.S. tech, but it's been a long run. And we're keeping our eyes open to that. We don't believe that we're in a bubble for AI right now. We do believe that it's going to be a challenging environment that comes and goes and fits and starts. And our eyes are going to be open to the potential for that to inflate into a bubble at some point down the road here.
What would things be like if AI hadn't come along and, you know, ignited this expansion in the market? I think it would be... I mean, there's no way of knowing, obviously, but it certainly, you know, it explains why we've had such a long run and why, you know, but seeing as how early on it is for AI as well, that there's a lot more runway ahead of it.
Yeah, obviously, it's galvanized a subset of the market. We've seen more spending on power generation. We've seen more spending in construction of data centers. We've seen more spending, obviously, on semiconductor chips and that sort of thing. But it has been fairly narrowly focused. And as much as it's been a major contributor to the incremental growth in GDP in this past year, a lot of the incremental capital expenditure has been in those areas. It's not like the underlying situation wasn't that healthy, it was pretty good. We've had a tremendous decade-long run of shifting to the cloud, and it hasn't just been the hyperscalers, the Mag 7 names that have benefited.
Right.
It's cascaded down through software and hardware and all those sorts of things. So we were on a pretty good trajectory, but it did feel like that was starting to mature. It's by no means fully penetrated. So even that area of growth looks healthy. I think, you know, AI has been around a lot longer than 3 years, even though it's, you know, your seminal moment was the launch of ChatGPT. It's been around for well over a decade. In fact, you can go back a lot farther than that for the more experimental, you can go back decades for the experimental science.
Right.
But in terms of coming to the fore, yes, it's been a 3-year thing so far in terms of really hitting the capital markets. But I do think we were okay otherwise. I think the challenges are some of the other things we've already talked about.
Yeah.
The COVID stimulus has resulted in a reset in interest rates that's been challenging, has been painful, and a fair amount of inflation along the way. Rising debt levels are starting to put pressure on fiscal spending, on sovereign bonds and that sort of thing. The tariff situation, a retrenchment, is a clear shock to the global economy. And it's these things that kind of have weighed on us in the last few years. Coupled with, you know, having had a good run, valuations are towards the higher end of the range. So in that respect, I think you're right. The advent of AI as a capital market theme has been fortuitous, but I think it's been a confluence of events that have resulted in still some good underlying capital market returns, but also some periodic challenges along the way.
Implicit in what we've been talking about up till this point is the risks. What are the key risks or wild cards that you believe advisors and investors alike should keep front of mind as we get into 2026?
There's no such thing as a perfect investing environment. And there's also no such thing as a hopeless investing environment. There's always something that's looking shaky and disturbing, and there's always something that's looking encouraging or enticing.
How are you positioning across equities, fixed income, cash, and credit in light of this environment? What's informing your stance on high yield, emerging markets, and cash readiness?
Yeah, so we have touched on the equity side of things. It kind of went over it geographically. The only thing I would add to that is that we are right now actually equal weight equities. Again, how do I tie that into the notion that we're still constructive as our base case for 2026? We just feel like the market's gotten a little bit ahead of itself in the last few months, and we've been looking for a period of a bit more retrenchment. Arguably, we've gotten some aspect of that in the last 3 months where the pace of appreciation has really slowed down here and has become somewhat more choppy. We're still hitting some new highs, but it's not that massive or that rapid advance that we saw in the second quarter and the third quarter. And if we were to see a little bit more of a retrenchment than we've seen so far, we reset sentiment, we get some sort of a hiccup that results in something more than a 3-5% correction, we would view that as probably a good opportunity to increase exposure to equities again. On the fixed income side of things, we have now been in a 3-year environment of mid-single digit returns. So fixed income gets a bad rap to some extent because it didn't pay you anything for well over a decade. And then we went through a monster bear market in 2022. And everybody knows that you got to worry about inflation when you're investing in fixed income. You look at all of that and you say, well, geez, this hasn't been a good environment. And yet quietly, over the last 3 years, you've been able to garner mid-single digit returns. That's pretty effective because you want something with not as much volatility that pays a steady stream of income that gets you a good portion of the way towards your goals. If your goal is to make, let's say, upper single digits, a lot of people will talk about a 6-7% return or something like that. You get 7, you double your money every 10 years. If fixed income is paying you 4.5 or 5, that's a much better world than paying you 1.5 or 2, because it really helps you get a long portion of the way towards achieving that 6-7% return objective. We think we're in for more of the same. We think that if you've still got some monetary easing ahead of you in 2026, even if it's less than we've seen the last year or two, there should be a favorable backdrop there, coupled with the disinflation that I mentioned that we still think is in place currently. And so another coupon clipping mid-single digit kind of year does not seem out of the question at all for us. But we are a little bit underweight because there's still the potential risk of an increase in inflation down the road, and because the return prospects look lower than they do for equities. So we're a little bit underweight. One thing we haven't talked about that you just touched on is credit and emerging markets on the fixed income side of things. We're more constructive on those areas. For credit and emerging markets, we're still seeing attractive all-in yields. Yes, spreads have narrowed as the market backdrop has gotten healthier. But that just means that in our view that we've got a pretty well-supported set of categories that should be able to service their debt reasonably well with low default rates. And that looks pretty intriguing to us. If we can get upper single-digit returns from those areas, that makes sense to us. So those are our favorite areas for 26. And cash a little bit overweight. Cash doesn't pay as much as it did over the last couple of years, but it pays a lot more than it did over the previous 15. And it gives us optionality. So if we do see that pullback in equities, it's a little bit more robust, or we just think we've had enough time to consolidate, then maybe that presents an opportunity to redeploy some cash back into the equity markets at some point early next year. And at the moment, that's what we're anticipating would be our next move.
Wonderful. David, thank you so much for your incredibly valuable time and insight. It's been terrific catching up with you.
Super. Thanks very much again for the opportunity, Pierre. Really appreciate it.